Welcome to The Peg Doesn't Fit, the podcast that brings you the change makers in education. Tune in to hear from educational leaders who aren't content with the status quo educational model and are blazing their own path.
All right, welcome everybody to The Peg Doesn't Fit. Today we have Dan McGuire with us from Minneapolis, Minnesota. He works for Sabier. And you are here to be the savior of education. It's capital S-A-B-I-E-R, and he will tell us a little bit about that acronym in a little bit. But first, let's start with, Dan, your educational journey. How did you get now to where you are today?
Sure. Thanks, and I appreciate you having me here. Enjoy meeting you. I enjoy learning how to do something new that hasn't been done before or that hasn't been done by very many other people. And then I enjoy showing other people how to do that. So in my history is that after studying classics in college, history and humanities, I got a job at a telecommunications engineering and systems implementation company. For instance, I did the wiring and component testing of a custom designed security communication system at the 3M headquarters in St. Paul. And I went from there, that job, to studying creative writing in a graduate program at the University of South Dakota. And from there, I went into sales of business telecom equipment. And I had a variety of positions in a few different companies. Names you would recognize would be AT&T and Bell Atlantic. One of the last deals I did in the telecom business was I sold central office systems to a state-owned telecom company in China. Now, the customer was a Guangxi Post and Telephone, and the equipment was for a central office telephone system in the area of Wuchao, which had previously never had electronic switching. So I'm probably one of the few people to do a profitable deal shipping telecom equipment to China. And we shipped the first of what was going to be 10 quarterly shipments of materials in March of 1989. And Tiananmen Square happened in April of 1989. So after that first shipment, the State Department shut down anything with a microprocessor going to China. So that was the end of that job. And the next year, I went back to school to get an elementary teaching license. I had decided I had enough of the corporate world. And I did that the old-fashioned way. I did all the required courses and the practicum and the student teaching. And there weren't any shortcuts to a licensure in those days. And I spent the next 16 years teaching in the Minneapolis public schools in elementary grades, primarily a third and fourth grade combined classroom. Teaching there led me to learning how to use Moodle for instruction and then how to discovering OER to use with Moodle. My tech background led me to be easily curious in computers and things, and so Moodle was easy for me to pick up. And I left the Minneapolis Public Schools in 2011 and did independent consulting for ed tech software companies and did professional development for teachers and faculty in the use of Moodle for teaching and learning. And then in 2016, I founded Sabier, which is a nonprofit that supports teachers in using OER in an LMS, as well as supporting the development of new OER. And that's what I'm doing now.
So tell us a little bit about OERs. I believe it stands for Open Educational Resource. What all does that entail? You know, is that only hardware tech? Is that a textbook? Is that software? Where does that fall?
OER, and it's a collective plural. So when I say OER, they are educational materials that are free and are able to be legally modified to fit the specific needs of students. It's not software and it's not hardware. In the software business, there's the open source software, which is somewhat parallel to open educational resources, except that open educational resources are just the content that exists within software. So like OER are the words in the document that you're reading on a Word doc. The Word doc itself is produced by software. Mm-hmm. And that may or may not be open source software. And the beauty of OER materials are, first, that they're free, and the fact that they're a teacher can modify them to create assignments for the specific needs of their students is what makes them really kind of magical and really useful. And it is possible to have OER in print form, and that's used in some places. But the problem with OER in print is it's pretty difficult to do revisions. You can't modify printed stuff. Mm-hmm. So OER is really practical when it's used as a digital material, and it's most practical when it's used in a learning management system. I mean, okay. There are OER materials that are just Word docs, for instance, that have an open license on them that I can post someplace and you can copy and revise and use however you want. But if I put those on a learning management system, then we can create assessments that go with them, and we can create opportunities for students to use the discussion tools in the LMS to talk about the problems that the teacher presents to the student. And that's where the real learning happens, when you get students talking about the issues. And to give you an idea why OER is so valuable to teachers, let me tell you about one of the teachers I'm working with currently in the northern region of Ghana. His name is Peter Amawabu. He's an incredibly dedicated and innovative teacher and really great to work with. Now, the school where Peter teaches has no internet access at all. Nothing except the use of his personal cell phone as a hotspot. He teaches fifth grade. None of the students or anyone in their families have ever used a digital device of any kind. So our nonprofit, Sabier, supplied Peter with a portable Moodle server and Wi-Fi devices for his students. And then we showed Peter how to create learning activities for his students on the portable Moodle system. And that portable Moodle system is called Moodle Box. We can talk more about that later. But and then we showed Peter how to add OER materials to modify them. And then we showed him some places where he could discover some more materials. And then I was just totally blown away when Peter showed me the digital OER book in the mother tongue of the people in the area where he teaches. And he had loaded that onto the Moodle box for his fifth graders. And then he created his own comprehension quiz in Dagbani. Dagbani is the language that is spoken mm-hmm. around that area. And the kids were just delighted to be able to read their mother tongue on these digital devices. He said they just were thrilled with it. Now, here's one of the things about this that was news to me. Ghana has 11 official languages. There's 80 languages altogether. But there are only 11 of them are official. And the Ministry of Education requires that teachers teach in the mother tongue for the first 3 years. and then gradually introduce English as appropriate, determined by the teachers. Well, the catch-22 here is that the Ministry of Education can't afford to produce materials in all 11 languages. Mm-hmm. They're actually having trouble producing materials in English, which is the dominant official language. Yeah. So when Peter can find a book in Dagbani to use with his students, he's representing their culture right within the official curriculum, which is a really powerful thing for students. And he can switch back and forth from Dagbani to English as much as he wants. And then the activities that he's creating, he's actually building a course. When he's finished with that, he can upload that to a repository where other teachers in Ghana can then now use it. So he's really breaking new ground. And the model, that model of taking languages and incorporating them into the standard curriculum, that's something that can be replicated everywhere, probably in Kansas.
Yeah. I like this. I want to go a lot of different directions.
Sure.
So for you as a nonprofit business, what's the business model? How do you make this work for, it sounds like on the teacher end, is this free for me to, well, I'll back up with my own understanding of OER in general has been about the open source nature, free for everyone, let's all contribute, kind of like, you know, operating systems and whatever. Would that be a true statement to begin with?
Yes, but let's not put operating systems in there, because that's the software.
I was thinking more of philosophical.
Philosophically, you're absolutely right. And OER actually is an outgrowth of the open source software world. Mm-hmm. Because the open source software world was successful, then around the turn of 2000 or so, people said, well, can't we apply this same concept to content?
Yeah.
Which content is ruled by a different copyright than mm-hmm. software is. So OER is a license that is added to traditional copyright. Mm-hmm. So when I create a third grade science curriculum that's been aligned to the science standards for the state of Minnesota, which, by the way, I did as a mm-hmm. when I was working with the Minnesota Partnership for Collaborative Curriculum, the collaborative paid me as the teacher and author of that, and they also paid other teachers to review it and check it, and so a team of people checked it. But once that got created, then I don't get paid anymore. Right now, mm-hmm. it's hosted on a website of the Minnesota Partnership, and you can download it and use it in your classroom if you want.
Okay.
But that's the concept, that we get paid the first time for creating it by whoever is interested in creating the content. I could also create content on my own without getting paid and then contribute that. I like the part of the reason, part of the mission of Sabier is to support teachers in getting paid for creating content mm-hmm. and also for getting paid to learn how to use them. So Peter in Ghana is getting paid a stipend by Sabier for the work he's doing, because we believe in the teacher should get paid. The content that he's using has already been created by somebody else. Now, the stipend isn't enough to cover the value that he's producing, but we're working on that. You know, mm-hmm. And you know, that's one of the things in the OER world is how do we get the people that have been traditionally paying for content to start paying teachers to create the content?
I like this. Okay.
The issue is not that we don't have enough money.
Mm-hmm.
The state of Kansas spends plenty of money on curriculum. So does the state of Minnesota. Every state, the federal government in the U.S. spends a lot of money on curriculum. But it's not going into it's going into the pockets of venture capital companies that own some publishing outfits. We don't need to do it that way.
Mm-hmm.
Our teachers are smart. The character on SNL used to say, "We're good enough and smart enough to do this."
Yeah, right.
As every teacher I've known, I mean, teachers are well educated, and you know we're capable of doing this if we're organized and can legally do it and supported by our organizations to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So the purpose of Sabier is to just be an impetus to start that change.
Okay. Do you feel, well, give me your response to this idea, but I feel like maybe with this, we're in the same transition phase that we underwent when early days of the internet, people were like, World Book and the New Book of Knowledge is the only source of your information. Don't you dare trust Wikipedia. And there was kind of this transition to where now we're like, who even uses World Book anymore? And we kind of trust the vetting process in general, not by and large.
Also, of course.
Not everybody does trust Wikipedia. But there's kind of like this movement into, can we trust the teachers? Because I can pay to trust Pearson, which ironically, when you open those textbooks, what's in the very front? Teacher,
exactly.
Teacher, principal,
exactly.
College professor wrote this book.
Absolutely. You hit it. You know, those books were created by teachers and college professors.
Right.
So we're trusting the same people.
Right. But we're paying the middleman, Pearson. A lot of money to pay the teachers less. Yeah.
Exactly.
So you're kind of proposing almost like a more, in a sense, a direct to the producer payment model, maybe.
Absolutely. Yes. But what's more important than that is that I can modify that.
Right.
Now, the stuff that comes from the legacy publishers, I can't legally modify it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you usually in the workbooks that come, there's a little thing and says that the teacher can copy this for use within their own class. So I could make 25 copies of it I want. Or right. If I'm a high school science teacher, I can make 150 copies. But beyond that, teachers don't have the legal right to copy it. And they don't have the legal right to modify it,
mm-hmm.
to change it. You have to use it the way it comes in the book. And I haven't met a teacher yet who teaches straight out of the book. I mean, nobody teaches straight out of the book.
Mm-hmm.
We all can think of a better way. I mean, that's why we got into this job. We want to put our own personality and view into this, the one that connects with the students, because we know the students and we develop that relationship with them, and we know how to phrase it so that it makes the best sense to them. Mm-hmm. So let's put that in the official curriculum.
Right.
And OER gives us the legal right to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And also, so for instance, one district might decide they want to do a project on their local history. So they can add that to their official history book. you know, whatever grade we're teaching history in, if it's in, I don't know, fifth grade, and then again in 11th grade, you know, whatever it is, we can add that into the curriculum, and we can do it county by county, or, you know, you can put your own town's story into the official curriculum. And that puts more added weight to it for the students, and it actually helps engage them. And that's the real power of OER, is in the ability to modify it to fit the needs of the student. And it's free.
I like it. Have you run into any, that you're aware of through your work, any state or district roadblocks when it comes to policy? Like they would say, no, we must purchase this. Or is it more just a mental game of letting themselves convince themselves it's okay to pay their teachers to create this work?
There's lots of roadblocks. Most of them are what I call organizational structural ones.
Okay.
There are lots of people at the building level, the district level, and the state level who are making their living, who are professionals at making sure that the appropriate curriculum is in the appropriate schools. So we have this system set up that the State Department of Education signs off on certain curriculum, and the curricula team at the school make sure that whatever curriculum is purchased by the superintendent meets the standards that have been prescribed by the state. And there are systems for doing that. So anything that upsets that system causes resistance. So yes, there's lots of resistance because this is a new way of doing it. Mm-hmm. It also takes the power away from some people.
Yeah.
They can no longer prescribe. There are school districts, as we are well aware, that want to prescribe exactly what will be taught. And we want to pretend that our teachers are never going to deviate from that script. Okay, we can get into that, but not today. the thing is that some states, even I've run into states that want to prescribe this specific curriculum, and they're not particularly interested in having teachers make modifications. Mm-hmm. Because it's the way I look at it, that's what they see their job as prescribing the curriculum. So yeah. So they want to do that.
Is there I hear you mentioning like modifying the textbook, but in a sense, is it, I mean, I'm just creating supplemental materials most of the time, right? So how does a legislator or somebody or a curriculum director even know that this is happening? Because some of it sounds more like just normal teaching. You could call it guerrilla tactics if you really want to put it on the cynical side, but I just think it's like, it's what teachers do anyway.
Right, it is. It is exactly what teachers do anyway. But we're talking about making the official textbook that manner.
We're trying to rewrite the whole thing, yeah.
And I'm not the only one. I'm not the only one. So
there's Libre Texts, right?
Libre Text is primarily in higher ed. They do have some K-12 sources, but that's a minor part of them. Mm-hmm. And I think we should back up and explain first that OER was established primarily initially for the higher ed market.
Okay.
And there's a difference. The higher ed market and the K-12 market are very different when it comes to curricular materials. Mm-hmm. In the higher ed market, we have developed a system where, in general, the individual students pay for the curriculum. Mm-hmm. Now, that may or may, and that's especially true in the U.S. That's not true all over the world. But we've developed that system. If you go to college, you have to buy your own books. That was the traditional system.
Right.
The OER innovation to that is to create an alternative to requiring students to buy the textbook. Mm-hmm. And it also enabled professors to actually write their own textbooks,
okay,
which is very attractive to lots of professors in higher ed.
Yeah.
But now in higher ed, in K-12, students historically in the U.S. don't buy their own books. Mm-hmm. The school district buys them for them. So it's an entirely different market. So, and typically, curriculum purchases are done by grade level or by middle school. The middle school will adopt a math curriculum or a language arts curriculum or a history mm-hmm. curriculum. And so they'll buy a set of books for all three grades. Well, the making those OER has been a slow process. And so far, we've got a math curriculum that has been created in for the entire K-12. And it started out in middle school, and then went to high school. And now illustrative mathematics is the largest openly licensed full comprehensive curriculum. And it's the one that's being used by the most schools throughout the country. There are openly licensed reading curriculum. EL Education is one of the names there. In the science field, OpenSciEd is currently...
OpenSciEd. I'm going to write that one down. We're looking at new science curriculum for next year.
OpenSciEd is an open source curriculum.
Okay.
I mean, not open source. It's an openly licensed curriculum.
Uh-huh.
Now, what has happened historically, and one of the things that we're working at with Sabier, in the higher ed market, the textbooks got created as OER, but the assessments have continued to be purchased by the students. So there are lots of companies that sell assessments to professors that accompany the textbooks.
Correct.
So they're assessment systems. And essentially, they're learning management systems that are licensed per grade and per topic.
Mm-hmm.
But they're actually learning management systems with a specific focus. Similarly, in K-12, we have companies now. For instance, I mentioned illustrative mathematics. It's a very highly regarded mathematics curriculum. It's been vetted by all of the major vetters of curriculum. It's been adopted by lots of school districts, LAUSD, New York, lots of big school districts. And there are four companies that have taken illustrative mathematics and made digital versions of them that they then sell as proprietary digital products to schools. So they take the OER content and they put them into an LMS, and then they license that to the schools. So there are school districts, for instance, let's say LAUSD, because I've actually done some things with them. They have a Schoology LMS, and they pay a vendor that provides assessment systems for their illustrative mathematics system in addition to that. So, and that's why I say what Sabier is doing is showing schools and teachers how to use their learning management systems to create the assessments within the learning management systems that they already own.
Mm-hmm.
So that they don't have to go out to the proprietary companies that are creating the assessment systems to accompany the openly licensed content.
Okay. So that kind of gets into my question about your role. So are you primarily a trainer of teachers, or do you host the repository of all the work that the teachers create? Or how does your role fit into
we're professional development providers.
Okay.
And we are coaches for curriculum writing. Mm. So we've done both. Actually, so far we've done probably more writing and revising of OER than we have done professional development, primarily because there hasn't been a widespread adoption of school districts doing the assessments within their own LMSs yet. That's coming. So one of the projects we did during the pandemic is that we worked with a company called GeoGebra to create a digital version of illustrative mathematics that could be accessed via a learning management system. That was a big project, and that's available. We don't host anything. We use publicly available repositories. The big ones are, the ones we like to promote are MoodleNet.
Okay.
MoodleNet it's been around for a few years, but it's taken on a new revision in the last couple of years. They finally recognized the power of OER. So there's now quite a commitment in the Moodle community to support the adoption of OER.
Okay.
And so anything that is created on a Moodle system can be uploaded to MoodleNet. And then anyone on the planet can access MoodleNet for free and download that content to their Moodle system.
Hmm.
So we uploaded all of those GeoGebra illustrative mathematics courses that we created to MoodleNet. You can look for them there and download them. And we also made sure that the Moodle courses that we created would run in the other LMSs. So if you currently use Schoology or Canvas, you can still download those Moodle courses and run them in either Schoology or Canvas.
Okay.
So that
are there other, you said MoodleNet is one repository. Are there some others too?
Well, there's one that's Minnesota Partnership for Collaborative Curriculum is one.
Okay.
The Oregon State has a repository. Michigan has a repository. OER Commons is one that's a pretty large repository, but it doesn't host complete LMS courses. It only hosts pieces of them, essentially worksheets and unit materials. They don't have full LMS courses like MoodleNet does.
So that would be maybe similar to the popular equivalent, or the equivalent that's popular with teachers, which is Teachers Pay Teachers. Kind of like, have you heard of that?
Oh yeah, I've heard of that.
Yeah. So yes. I mean, in that way, it's like, that's a place that holds worksheets.
Yes.
But not really complete courses. It just holds worksheets. Okay.
OER would be similar to that. And it's all legal. Whereas Teachers Pay Teachers isn't.
Yeah.
Excuse me.
I'm curious about that. Where's the illegality of it? I know that we have been now told in our district that we should not, actually, I think this happened last year too, should not purchase from Teachers Pay Teachers, at least with the district would not support the purchase.
You shouldn't.
We're welcome to on their own dime, but.
Because Teachers Pay Teachers does not vet the material to make sure that it is original and properly licensed.
Okay.
So there's there's lots of things on Teachers Pay Teachers that have been pirated from other people.
Oh.
In some cases, they've taken OER materials that were licensed to be non-commercial use and put up there. That's one of the things we should probably talk about is the different licenses.
Yeah.
So within OER, there are different licenses that authors can choose to provide.
Okay.
So if I write a curriculum, I can say, you can have the curriculum, modify it, reuse it, and redistribute it, and you can even sell it if you want.
Mm-hmm.
That's what Illustrative Mathematics did.
Okay.
They put that CC BY license on it, which permits resale of the curriculum. That actually allows then those companies that want to put it into their LMS
mm-hmm.
to then, so they're remixing that OER by putting it into their LMS. And they are legally permitted then to sell that copy to other, or license it to other districts. Now, there are some people that create OER that put what's called an OER, a CC BY NC license on it, or non-commercial.
Okay.
That's the one that Sabier promotes, and that's the one that we would encourage most school districts, if you're going to, and we would encourage most states to do that, if a State Department of Education is going to commissioned some work on OER, mm-hmm. we would encourage you to use a non-commercial license.
Okay.
Because I don't think, you know, the state of Nebraska should be paying for content that can then be sold to somebody all over the country. And I'm going to guess that the legislators in Nebraska wouldn't be thrilled with that either, or the taxpayers. Whereas they would be interested in paying for curriculum on a one-time basis that could then be reused and revised by all the teachers in the state.
Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact,
within that idea, would it be, how do I word this? Or is the assumption, like if I'm the state of Nebraska and I buy this, is the assumption that now my teachers are collectively keeping it current, or do I need to eventually pay for another round of teachers to go in and do the rewriting work to update it, you know, in 5-6 years?
Well,
how does that work?
That's a great question. Let me put this back to you. How do you do it with your legacy publishers?
That we just put it on a cycle every 5 years or whatever we
you pay buy. you pay the same amount of money again.
Right.
So and then the answer is it can be updated as appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
Now, and this is what hasn't happened yet. I envision that we're going to be having state departments, and this has already started. The K-12 OER organization nationally is promoting this, to have state departments, and Washington State is one that has begun this. State of Iowa has begun it too. They each have repositories of OER materials. Iowa has a very large repository of OER materials. And what we expect is that most states will begin to acquire openly licensed content and then create their own statewide repositories.
Okay.
And then the idea there is that the State Department of Education, then, if they get paid by the legislature to create revision teams, new standards writing teams. So every so many years, the departments of education review the standards and they hire teachers to do that.
Correct.
So we're envisioning that the State Department of Education will hire teachers to revise the OER curriculum for the state.
Mm-hmm.
And it would make sense then to have the state universities, the college teacher colleges in the state to get involved. I can't think of a better teacher preparation course, you know, for my methods course, if I'm a teacher, I mean, if I'm a professor at a teacher college, I want to have my math teachers involved in the revision of the math curriculum that's the official math curriculum.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a perfect way to teach them what's in the curriculum, is mm-hmm. it help them get involved in the revision. And it also makes the professors at the teachers' colleges the actual authors then of the state curriculum and the revisers of the state curriculum. And now if it's OER, we can all legally do that, and we keep the money right there within the state.
Yeah. I hear you there. We just purchased new social studies curriculum for our district, and we're small. We've only got 200 kids district wide, but our social studies curriculum was about $24,000.
Oh my God.
And so you think about how could that have money been kept local?
Yeah.
I hadn't even thought about that. Just that idea of keep it local, which we can all resonate with.
Did you already write the check?
Yeah. Okay. I hit it, but science is up for next year. So,
okay.
But let me help. About even that idea that districts are like us are going, you know, every year we got something new
to
update, and we're spending. And
absolutely. That's the whole, that's the whole idea. And we might as well have the State Departments of Education earn their keep.
Right.
And those teacher colleges, you know, let's put them to good use too. You know, let's get them all involved with this. And so that everybody gets involved around the state and creates beautiful professional development for the in-service teachers and great training for the future teachers by revising the curriculum. And then we can, you know, the teachers will end up getting paid better. And the students in the state are going to have content that reflects their cultures.
Yeah.
And the social studies content will have material that has been gone over, and it fits with the whatever we've decided is the way we're going to do it in the state.
Is that where the vetting happens? Because you kind of had alluded to that, you know, teachers pay teachers isn't vetted material, but would that be a pushback, or where's the proof, I guess, that OER is getting vetted properly, you know, to make sure the state is delivering? Obviously at the state level, that's probably going to be encountering some oversight, but what about it?
Well,
the district level, would the state say, I don't know about that district down, you know, wherever, they're probably not going to.
Well, as a practical matter, let's look at it like this. We can use the state of Minnesota, which I'm very familiar with.
Uh-huh.
So the Minnesota Partnership for Collaborative Curriculum created content in grades 3-12 in English, math, social studies, and science.
Okay.
So there is curriculum created that covers all of the science standards in the state of Minnesota. And like I said, there was a team of teachers that were hired by the partnership to go over all of the content in there to make sure that A, it was properly licensed, and B, it was aligned to the standards.
Okay.
So that's the vetting process of that.
Gotcha.
And that's typically, like the illustrative mathematics curriculum was vetted by a team at the University of Arizona, and then they hired a bunch of other people all over the country. It was very highly vetted. And the open sci-ed stuff has got a very long list of well-credentialed people that have vetted their things. The EL education. That's the reading materials. It's all vetted. I mean, we got people to do the vetting, and we have departments of education that can, you know, write write rules about how things get done. Mm-hmm. We know how to do that.
Yes.
So
very good at that.
Yeah. So we can vet that stuff if we just make, if we decide that that's what we want to do. If we want to take control of the curriculum that we're teaching, we can do that.
Yeah. How would you talk to how does a teacher that's into this kind of thing, like if I'm sitting here in the middle of Kansas, can I just jump right in? And I know obviously I can create my own materials for my classroom, but maybe I want to contribute to the greater OER good. How do I get involved with that?
Well, I like to encourage people to work as a team. Mm-hmm. So ideally, just because some of my best ideas end up not being so very good when we actually, they see the light of day. So yeah. It's like working as a team is always better. But just for argument's sake, a teacher in the middle of Canvas could create a math unit. Mm-hmm. For instance, if you have a Moodle system, you create the learning activities in Moodle, you create assignments and quizzes and discussion prompts, you create the course there, you're free to upload that to MoodleNet. Now, it hasn't been vetted by anybody, and in the description that you upload to Moodle, you could probably be responsible to say that. Mm-hmm. And if I was a teacher and I was going to download that and use in my course, I'd want to say, okay, well, did Eric Steven write this? Did he know what he's talking about? How do I know that? So, and most OER content has the attributions pages on it so that we can see who was involved in the creation and what their credentials were.
Okay.
But you're certainly, an individual is certainly free to create content and submit it to OER Commons. I know within the that's true in the state of Washington, and so they. But and these systems haven't been well developed yet. We're just at the beginning stages here in the U.S. in K-12.
Mm-hmm. Are there other countries that are ahead of us, or is everybody at the beginning stages?
Everybody's pretty much at the beginning stages. I think other countries are going to begin to leapfrog the U.S.
Okay.
Because other countries aren't as invested in their corporate entities as we are. Especially in, I'm expecting this global South to make great strides in OER implementation.
Okay.
Because they don't have the history that we do. They don't have those in-place systems to replace. Yeah. And Wi-Fi devices are becoming more prevalent. Internet access is becoming more prevalent. I think that we didn't talk very much about the Moodle box.
That's crazy you said that. I was just thinking about circling back around to that.
Yeah, the Moodle box is one of the greatest inventions, and that's what has enabled us to do the work we're doing in Ghana. And Sabir is also part of a larger team with educational technology and researchers. And we have people on the team are in Veracruz, Mexico, Austria, the UK, Netherlands, Switzerland. The developer of the Moodle box is Nicola Martignoni. He's a Swiss computer science teacher. And it's a free version of Moodle that runs on a Raspberry Pi.
Okay.
A Raspberry Pi is a small, we maybe aren't getting this recorded, but it's a small computer that runs, will fit in this. And I can put it in my shirt pocket if I want. That's how big a Moodle box is. But it's on that server. That's a LMS server that has the capacity to hold as much content as any class could ever use. It has a built-in Wi-Fi router, and it will serve up to, you know, 30 students within 50 feet or so. So it'll cover a classroom.
Neat.
Yeah. Now, that's the only way we can deliver content to this classroom in northern region of Ghana. But it's the applications are going to be, I predict, in the U.S. as well. The biggest reason is security.
Yeah.
Because the Moodle box, when I put that Moodle box on my desk in a classroom, I give the Wi-Fi password to that Moodle box to my class. That's all that they're only going there. I can turn Wi-Fi off. If there's Wi-Fi in the building, I can ask. I can put a blocker on that classroom.
Yeah.
And the only Wi-Fi my students are going to get is the Wi-Fi that's on my Moodle box. All of the data, everything that they create, is going to be on that Moodle box.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to get hacked. It's not connected to the internet. And by the way, the hardware only costs $100.
Yeah, it's pretty cheap.
And the software to download to make it work is open source. So that's open source software that we put on the Raspberry Pi hardware that we then load openly licensed content onto.
Mm-hmm.
That's a little complicated. Yeah, but you know, and that application of the Moodle box is already being used in correctional facilities.
Okay.
Again, that's a place where they don't want the users going out onto the internet, and we can keep things very local. It's really practical for field trips. So a science teacher can have one of these and could have their science assessment on the Moodle box. They go out into the field and start taking measurements. Students can record their measurements, whatever they're measuring. It could be a geology. They could take a picture of the rocks they find, upload that, put them on the Moodle box. They do all of that and then have a picnic out there. It'd be a great field trip.
That's neat.
And you can bring that back and upload it to wherever you want and do whatever you want with it. So, you know, for $100, why wouldn't a science teacher want to have that ability? You know, you're going to take a little bit of time to learn how to do it, but again, it's real doable.
I think what's going through my head, I'm all about FOSS, free and open source software, for everybody who doesn't know what that means.
Yep.
And then even on the FOSS, you could say free and open source hardware.
Yes.
That's a growing element. And then you bring that in what you're talking about with OERs. Like, I think it just expands the possibilities for what's possible to educate people and humans.
Absolutely.
So massively. But here we live in the U.S. It's kind of we're in proprietary land.
Yeah.
And I think even with our software, people say, I just heard this phrase today. Now, this was actually an employee being asked if she would be willing to switch over from a Windows machine just to a Chromebook, which is still proprietary. But even that, she said, gotta have my Excel. Don't tell me that Google Sheets is, you know, the same. even that's just people switching from proprietary to proprietary. I know Google's free, quote unquote, but I've tried to run a Linux box at my own work to try to break free of some of that stuff. But I think about, well, we pay for, so people have the initial pickup already. I got to have my office suite. Well, guess what? There's a ton out there that are practically the same. To me, it's like getting in a car that's a Chevy or a Ford.
the buttons are practically all in the same place. Yes, it looks slightly different, but it's not that different. Yet we get so hung up on that.
Right.
And so I wonder, even with Moodle, which we don't have in my school, but I love the idea of it. I've used it in my college classes. It's a great system. That's free. But yet school districts are like, yeah, but we're paying for such and such already. And there's almost like this mental hurdle that is sometimes there's like this, there's mental, emotional hurdle. I think people have to hop over when it even comes to software to say, wait, but if I don't pay for it anymore, it almost seems risky. I don't know what it is, or if it's the habit of using the traditional products. I don't know.
What do you think? Well, you're absolutely right. That's there. That emotional attachment, and it's there big time when you talk to a superintendent or a school board. It's hard to get people who are traditionally responsible for buying materials for schools to actually say, oh, well, we're going to now become responsible ourselves.
Right.
And to a certain extent, if you just write a check, well, now, it's no longer your fault if something goes bad.
Right. Yeah. We paid for them to take care of it.
Yeah.
Whoever the collective they is.
Yeah. Right. Right. But that's a big deal if you're into being, if you're running a school, you know, whose fault is it? And being responsible for actually making sure it's vetted, now that becomes on us. That's why we need to have a team. That's why it has to be done at a district level and a state level, so that we can get past that ownership issue. And the team will provide us with that resource. Not that security of knowing that it's okay, that we'll be all right. Mm-hmm. And you know, there's open office systems that are just as good as Excel. Right.
There are. Yep. Use them all the time.
Yeah. And they even have some features that aren't on the other ones.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, for this, I think we should probably turn this into a part two sometime.
Okay.
We've already gone nearly an hour, which is awesome.
Sure.
I geek out about this stuff because this to me is one of the important I don't know if you call it element isn't quite the right word, but almost like a cornerstone of changing education is breaking free of proprietary chains.
Yes.
So to speak.
Absolutely.
And to me, that is such a powerful thing. I'm glad you're doing this work to help spread the love and provide that professional development to help teachers. So we'll have to create a time for a part two. How do people, if they want to get in touch with you, or follow Savior's work, what's the best way to do that?
Savior.org.
Okay.
Savier.org.
All right. Easy enough.
That acronym stands for Stone Arch Bridge Initiative for Education Resources.
Well, you'll have to tell us now. What did Stone Arch Bridge come from? What's that?
That's a bridge over the Mississippi River.
Okay.
Near the St. Anthony Falls in downtown Minneapolis. Hmm. The school I taught at for 15 years was on the other side of the river. I would take the bus from my house to if you've ever been to US Bank Stadium where the Vikings play, it's very near there. I would get off the bus, walk over the Stone Arch Bridge up the hill to my school. So I walked over that bridge countless times at 6:30 in the morning on the way to school. Sometimes in January, it was a bit nippy. And that's where I had some of my thinking about where we could go with education. So that's how it's also a good metaphor for bridging things.
Okay.
You know,
yep.
From the old to the new, we cross over the river and it's a good old acronym in Minneapolis, at least.
Yeah, I love it. So Savior.org.
Yes.
Well, thank you, Dan, for being on the show today.
My pleasure. Let's talk again. Let me know.
As always, thank you for checking us out at The Peg Doesn't Fit. We appreciate you listening. You can find us on Twitter at The Peg Doesn't Fit. You can find me at Ryan D. Bartle 1.
And my personal Twitter is at Eric J. Steven. You can also email us at thepegdoesntfit@gmail.com or leave us a voicemail at anchor.fm/thepegdoesntfit.
Drop us a 5-star review on iTunes. Tell your educator friends or family, anybody. We'd love to hear from you.
All right. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you next week on The Peg Doesn't Fit.